Welcome back to Pegging Paradise podcast number 200, part 3. Now we get to have a delightful conversation with Paul, Michelle's boyfriend, and he gives us a different perspective from the opposite side of the gender binary around all of these subjects. So stay tuned. Here we go. So I want to welcome to the podcast Paul. And I am bringing Paul in because of one thing specifically, even though I think he has a whole lot to share with us that you're going to find really interesting. I am bringing Paul in because Michelle and Paul, boyfriend, girlfriend, Michelle mentioned to me, and this is in the whole context of touch and men and all this stuff, Paul mentioned that there's like 7 steps between shaking another guy's hand and getting a hug. So that's the first thing I would love to hear about. But before we dive in, tell us a little bit about who you are.
Well, thank you for having me on the podcast. I'm a 30-year-old dude. I live in California now. And I've been with Michelle for like 2 years now, something like that. I work in software, and it's kind of the long and the short of it, really. Mm-hmm. I joined the kink community maybe about 2 years ago. I had kind of set out to do everything I was supposed to. I got the job I wanted. I, you know, went through college. I did all these things, and in the end, I wasn't happy. And so I started to live more adventurously. You know, I started going rock climbing. I got a motorcycle. I got a mohawk, and I joined the kink community. And more than anything, it was like this fantastic social group that, you know, was sex positive and, you know, all a bunch of huge nerds themselves.
Yes, yeah, sex nerds, absolutely.
Oh yeah, no, so there was a huge variety of new experiences and new things to learn. I ended up gravitating a lot towards rope, partly because it's, you know, this very technical thing, and there's a lot of, you know, to do with that, it's like an artistic thing, but it's also this wonderful sensation thing and this wonderful way to connect between the top and the bottom, mm-hmm. if that's what their scene is.
And connection and touch, that's a huge part of it. So when you first met Michelle, was she already doing her cuddless stuff?
You know, I don't actually remember. I think that, I know that at some point, I had to move away, and the only way we could be together was if she were to come visit me at this new location, mm-hmm. in California, like I said. And it sort of served as a lot of impetus for her to sort of get some of her ducks in a row. Mm-hmm. And so cuddling was the big part for that.
So before you moved to California, mm-hmm. did you have much experience with going to like cuddle parties or doing stuff like that? Or was your experience with like that connected touch thing, was that happening more like in the kink community?
It was happening more in the kink community. You know, uh-huh. I had gone through a fair amount of therapy, you know, to get out of depression.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, and I've put a lot of work into myself, and I really think I've come a long way. But one of the things I learned was that like a lot of the sort of social status quo as it is not very healthy for people in a lot of ways. And touch was one of them. So I had sort of before that started like living more emotionally and earnestly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a large majority of it was in the kink community and, you know, friends and relatives and that sort of thing. But I think the first cuddle party I went to was out here in California.
Was it at my house?
I had been to one before that, but the one at your house was quite lovely.
So first of all, I want to acknowledge and give you kudos for diving in and doing the therapy. That's a difficult thing. And I'm surprised that a realization of not enough touch came, it sounds like, relatively quickly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had, you know, done everything I was supposed to. I got the job I wanted. I was financially secure. I, you know, was surrounded by friends and stuff, but something was missing. And, you know, I turns out the friends I was hanging out with were not as close to me as I thought they were. You know, I was lacking a lot of social connection, but I was lacking a lot of physical connection as well.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, and as I understand it, that's actually really pretty normal for most men, sadly.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
That's something that, you know, a lot of this podcast is about. It, in a really interesting way, it has impacted both the things that I do and the things that Michelle does.
And absolutely.
With me teaching about all the strap-on stuff and pegging, I find so often that there are repercussions from men not really having a whole lot of touch and not being allowed to express their emotions, not having a lot of non-sexual touch mostly, and not being allowed to express emotions because sometimes pegging can bring up vulnerability and all kinds of things. And it's like the ultimate vulnerability is to do that. And so I've taken a good look at a lot of Mark Green's articles and things about how so many men are just touch starved and emotionally kind of starving.
Mm-hmm.
So was the emotion part of what you figured out about yourself as well?
It really was. It was a big part of it. I mean, I'm no expert on the subject, but as far as I can see, society does not train men well. It trains us to be stoic and strong and, you know, buck up and, you know, just be a man and, you know, man up. But it doesn't teach us how to process emotion. Doesn't teach us any sort of emotional intelligence, and it doesn't teach us any sort of connection at all, you know. So I was a bit far from that, in that I, you know, went to university and I had a bunch of nerdy friends, so I wasn't in the, you know, prototypical male quandary, or, you know, like right in the center of it. But you know, even then, it was, you know, it takes a lot for men to open up to each other, to share vulnerability, to talk about something other than, like, you know, video games or sports or whatever surface level thing is there. You know, I had the good fortune to have a couple of good friends who were very insightful, you know, really fantastic at helping me figure out some stuff.
Nice.
You know, like whether it was something that came up from therapy or something else, but they were really fantastic resources for me. But like, not everyone has that, you know, and society doesn't train men to process emotion. The only emotions, or that we even have them, you know, the only emotions we're allowed to have are lust and anger, really. Even sadness is, like, not one we're allowed to have. Like, my dad, like, his father passed away recently, like, about 2 years ago, and I don't think I saw him emotional that entire time while I was back for that.
Wow.
It was really rough. And, I mean, you know, a lot of his sisters were very emotional and stuff, and I was in a pretty good place at that point, so I just gave them all really, really good hugs until they, you know, and squeezed them a little bit too much until they started laughing.
At least they were able to let something out, yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so I think I did pretty well there. But
I guess I was hoping that, and you know, you're representative, and you were just someone in a different generation than me, because I'm 60. And the only time I ever saw my dad cry my entire life was when my mom died. That was the only time.
Yeah, I saw my dad open up maybe twice. And the first time was, you know, I ended up getting an internship at where he worked. And so I kind of got to understand why he was so stoic, or kind of learned to diffuse more from the ether, as it were. Because he's a manager and he works with a lot of people and he's in charge of a lot of people. So, you know, and he worked at the same job for like 35, 40 years or something like that. Just not the case of my generation. Pensions aren't a thing. And, you know, we're more interested in working at a job that we love than, you know, half-assing a job we hate until we can retire.
Yeah, which I love. I absolutely love that. I mean, I didn't come to embrace what I truly love until 10 years ago. And it's been the best 10 years of my life. Holy crap.
It's so much more alive. And
yeah,
I've had the good fortune to be able to be in a position to work hard towards that. But
yeah,
so I got to sort of see him open up. I got to understand subtleties in the stoicism. And the other time was we went backpacking. We went backpacking for about a week. Maybe about, and he loves the outdoors. And maybe about 2 or 3 days in, I just saw sort of the resting stern face just kind of relax.
Oh, wow.
It was really something to behold. I really wish I could get him to open up more, but, you know, it's not there. It's not the way things work. He's the eldest of seven. So
goodness,
he's had a lot of interesting pressure on him in his life.
Well, and society has so many factors that fights against any attempt to open up. Mm-hmm. It's not just how you were raised. It's everybody around you that judges you and shames you if you do something that's not accepted.
Yeah, it sort of reinforces the status quo.
Mm-hmm. So talk to me about the seven steps between between shaking a guy's hand and then actually being able to hug him as another man.
Before I do that, Michelle found a very fascinating documentary that was on Netflix at the time. I'm not sure if it still is, but it's called Behind the Mask. It's about...
Are you sure it's Behind the Mask or is it The Masks We Wear?
It might be The Masks We Wear. I'm not 100% sure, but the part that was most interesting that she shared with me was, you know, everyone's like, oh, you know, like at a certain age, these boys, you know, they're very emotional, they're very connected, and that just goes away.
Yeah, the little boys are. They absolutely are.
Mm-hmm. And the a lot of the people in there were like, we want this, we want to keep this, but we don't understand where it goes. But, you know, a lot of it is by, you know, school and society sort of reinforcing these things and stop crying and sports are a whole lot of work there towards sort of stoic masculinity and that sort of thing.
Do you have any memory of that transition yourself of when all of a sudden touch became not an okay thing, that tender, loving, non-sexual touch?
I'm not sure about touch necessarily. I was always kind of a happy child. When I really started to lose a lot of that was maybe in high school and college, mm-hmm. partly from just there being so many people around, being put into a new situation and that sort of thing. But mm-hmm. I remember the last days of middle school, I was literally in tears because I was like, I'm never going to see half these people again.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah, because due to a quirk of the system, half of my middle school went to one high school and the other half went to a different one. We were like right on the border.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I remember that, but I don't remember really what it was that pushed us away from that. I don't know.
Well, there's a lot of peer reinforcement that comes from that whole thing about, you know, be a big boy, don't cry, buck up and deal, and all of those things that you already mentioned. And I think that gets carried on so intensely as a type of mm-hmm. peer judgment, peer shaming, peer pressure, whatever you want to call it. Especially in the educational realm.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even just the sort of things where you would, you know, say something where, oh, don't be gay or something like that. And there was like a lot of like, oh, you know, don't hug other dudes that's gay. And, you know, at the time that was seen as kind of a negative thing, or at least it was, people were ribbing each other for it still.
Yeah, the strange thing I find now with the even younger generation than you are, is that that is one of the most common insults between men, is that's so gay. And it's weird because it's like they don't even necessarily mean it as homosexual. Yes. And it's so hurtful to homosexuals. But at the same time, it's like you're criticizing or like you're a pussy or you get totally shamed or given a hard time if you do anything that can even be remotely seen as feminine. And that emotional, open, vulnerable connectedness is the very thing that men need to be more whole, and yet they make fun of.
Yeah, it's sort of self-reinforcing to trend away from it. It had nothing to do with whether anyone actually was homosexual or not. It was just the vernacular of the time for, you know, non-traditional or whatever. But yeah, so touch between men and women are very different. You know, like I said, I saw this fantastic comic that illustrates it very well.
Okay.
Human Comics. She has this stages of hugs. You know, and for women, she says, you know, she spent a lot of time in airports and has seen all the common physical greetings between Western men and women. For mm-hmm. women, it's a handshake or the one-arm hug or a full hug. For men, it's the handshake where you grab their arm, handshake where you grab their shoulder, handshake where you go in to turn it into a hug and you give them pats on the back, regular hug with pats on the back, hug where you like kind of, you know, do pats on the back and then maybe it lingers a little bit and then you rub their back a little bit, and then a full hug.
Oh my my God.
It's this granular like maze of what makes sense. And, you know, by and large in my life, I've tried to just eschew that and just try to hug everyone, you know, just be like, hey, would you mind a hug? That sort of thing. And, you know, it's really a better way to connect with people. It gets rid of a lot of the formality and the bullshit that we have constructed to, you know, I don't know, keep everyone's feelings intact or something like that.
Yeah. And do you find that that is an easier thing to accomplish in the kink community?
Absolutely. I mean, even just in California, it's people tend to be more, I don't want to say enlightened, but certainly more touch friendly.
Interesting.
Yeah, I had a friend who moved out to, I think, West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And she had lived in California for a long time. And while she came back, she ended up coming back and she was like, it's awful out there. Like, everyone who's there, who is living in this town, always lived in this town. And they're not interested in making new friends because they have their friends since high school. And, you know, they really don't care about anyone new in town. And, you know, when someone says, hey, how are you doing? The only thing you're ever allowed to say is fine. And then you move on.
Wow.
You can't say like, oh, yeah, I've been feeling kind of depressed lately. You know, I just... it's been kind of rough on me out here, and I've been really thinking long and hard about I'm kind of miss home and I miss spending time with my boy. People don't want to hear that out there. It's just like a social formality. It's a different sentimentality out there. And I'm like, well, maybe it's just that you didn't find the right people. You know, like when I moved out to California, I wasn't worried about making good friends because I'm like, well, I have the kink community. There'll be a lot of like-minded individuals there.
Mm-hmm.
But one, they don't really have that in West Virginia. And two, I'm like, well, why don't you just hang out at the coffee shop and, you know, meet some cool people there? And she's like, they don't have one. The only thing that was in town was a bar and a Walmart. That's it.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah, so she was kind of out in the boonies, I guess. But, like, she did not have a good time.
One of the things I've noticed about the kink community, there's so many people that have so many misconceptions about it. And I know I get all kinds of different listeners for this podcast. I get people who aren't into kink at all and just really want to explore pegging in a very sensual sort of vanilla-ish way, if you will. And I absolutely mean nothing negative when I refer to vanilla. But what I've noticed is that a lot of people who don't have any experience with kinky people or with kink themselves, one of the concepts that they don't get is that there is so much more connection in terms of communication and negotiation.
Yes.
That sort of by default brings us all closer together. Anybody that you choose to play with, you communicate and you negotiate until you're both satisfied with what you're describing sounds right, and then you do it. And there's so much trust involved, too. So just all of that, it's like this magical way of creating a certain level of intimacy between people.
Absolutely. You kind of start further along the path. You know, it's that's how I explain kink to people. It's like, yeah, okay, there's this, you know, sex element to it. But, like, more than anything else, and when I described it earlier, I said this as well. More than anything else, it is a group of people who champion examining the status quo and questioning it.
Mm-hmm.
They champion communication. They champion individual freedom and positivity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if there's something that someone is into that it squicks me out or I don't think it's moral or whatever, it doesn't matter. It's like, that's you. You do what makes you and your whoever you're playing with happy. It
yes.
doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic. Like I said, it's like what actually goes on is almost irrelevant to the sense of sort of enlightened community that you have. One of the things that Michelle and I do is we do a lot of sensation play, but one of the is edge play with like knives and such.
Mm-hmm.
And for me and her, it's never really a fear element. There's not like a power exchange or anything like that. It's all sensation.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's just what it looks like for us. For other people, it's something different. But we can still talk about it within those contexts. It's all still equally valid.
Yes, I find so many different... And that is why, that's exactly why so much communication and negotiation is needed. I mean, I run into that when in the pegging formula, sometimes some guys, when they start experiencing it, or even before, they really are quite clear that they would like their partner to be more dominant. And so sometimes, you know, from a desire to be communicative and upfront with what they're looking for, they say, I really want you to be more dominant. Oh my God, do you know how many definitions of that there could be?
Right. I was going to say, like, a huge part of it is that they just want to, like, most people haven't had that communication about what that looks to each other. Like, someone's, I want you to be more dominant is, hey, I'd like you to ask for things or give me feedback. You know, just tell me what it is you want. That's to some people more dominant, you know, or maybe it is like, I don't want you to give me any say in this and just listen for my safe word or whatever. It's massively different.
It is.
It's like, what is cheating? You know, it looks different to every couple, even if with every group or whatever. It's like, for each individual person in that, it's different. You know, is masturbation cheating? Is looking at porn cheating? Is having an emotional relationship with another person cheating? Most of the time, these individuals have never had a discussion about it. There's just been this sort of assumed status quo. And that's the problems happen when those assumptions are different. When they say, well, obviously this is cheating. And the other person says, like, no, I just met them for coffee. There's no interest on me romantically. And they said, no, you're not allowed to have female friends or something like that.
And it seems as if the skill of actually communicating well and thoroughly and honestly and cleanly about all those things is hampered so much because the skills of basic emotional intelligence aren't offered up to men because they're not allowed to have their full range of emotions. And conversely, women aren't either. No, it's okay for you guys to be angry. What's the other one?
Anger and lust.
Yes, and for women, we're not supposed to be angry. Lust is frowned upon too.
Mm-hmm. Women are taught to compromise first.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually interesting. A friend of mine and I follow the competitive gaming scene, mm-hmm. esports as it were, and we were noting that only recently there was the first sort of professional female gamer. I forget which team it was, but they signed a cis female onto the team. And she was sort of the first professional cis female.
Wow.
We noticed that there were actually quite a lot of trans women who were professional gamers, who were on teams and sponsored and all of that. And we sort of postulated that part of the reason is that, you know, those individuals, those trans women, still received male training socially as a child.
Wow.
And so they were kind of taught to be less agreeable and to be more driven, and that success was less, or that failure was less of a okay thing for them. Because a lot of times that is the case for female training socially, is that, you know, it's okay if you fail, you know, you just need to compromise, don't be bossy, that sort of thing.
Yep.
And so we thought that was kind of interesting. Again, we're no experts on it, but we thought it was kind of an interesting theory.
It's a fascinating observation, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Even in the cuddling community, it blows my mind because that can be the biggest challenge in a cuddle gathering, is to get the women to be authentic as opposed to compulsively compromise.
Yep, to ask for what they want, to have a no.
Yeah, to get out of a situation that makes them uncomfortable.
One of my favorite lines from the welcome circles that I've been in is, you know, if anyone here is a caretaker, you have the night off.
That's nice. I like that.
I really like that because, you know, a lot of people, myself included, you know, I want to make sure everyone has a good time, but sort of giving everyone who's there license to be selfish, to look for something that you want, to really be earnest.
Yeah, I was telling Michelle this. I have a woman friend who is around 40, maybe early 40s. And I was telling her about this whole cuddle gathering thing because I was so excited about it. And I said, I'm going to do these at my house. And so I'm wondering, you know, would you be interested in coming? And she's single. And the very first thing she said after she thought about it for a while and heard me describe how cool it was, because I was just, you know, waxing poetic about it, she said, well, I don't know. I'm afraid that I'd be the one sitting in the corner that no one would ask to cuddle.
Yeah.
And that is just so opposite my personality. I just kind of tilted my head and looked at her and said, why wouldn't you ask someone to cuddle?
Yeah.
And her eyes just flew open and she said, that didn't even occur to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of issues that we have with society training is just that people haven't thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people in a relationship haven't thought about what they consider cheating.
Mm-hmm.
It never occurred to them that this might be a thing. And I mean, you know, school doesn't do a good job of preparing people for anything a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of train your mind, but like the fact that we have at the high school level, you know, options for calculus, you know, taking AP calculus and stuff, but there's nothing that teaches you how to do your taxes or make a budget.
I know. Or balance your checkbook.
Exactly. It's frightening and alarming, to be frankly honest. I definitely remember hearing a story about someone who like took a week, a teacher who took a week to do this, and they ended up getting chastised for teaching outside of their expertise.
Oh my God, it drives me nuts. So
mm-hmm.
Here's a question for you. And
yes.
Just from your own perspective, what I'm wondering is, you know, we're kind of on this, it's not really a precipice, but it's a transition where more and more people are realizing how we're screwing up in terms of differentiating in how we raise different gendered children.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so much other stuff going on too about gender fluidity, which is fantastic. But the whole, okay, you got to be a man or you have to be a woman and you have to follow these rules. But the awareness is really becoming heightened because of a lot of people doing a lot of really good work. So during this transitional period, as someone who, you know, some people call themselves recovering Catholics.
Yeah.
Well, it's like you're a recovering, raised as a typical guy sort of thing. And so given that, and you've done so much work on yourself already, with any kind of hindsight that you might have, how can the people around men who are trying to get through this and get to the other side like you're doing and how can we support you? That's the best way I can phrase it.
So it's tricky, right? Because there's a lot of problems that parents face. There's a lot of things that they need to teach their kids. And by and large, almost everyone's only example is their own upbringing. Very few people will actually go and read about, you know, how to raise their children correctly or how to do things this way or consider that. You know, very rare will people actually do that. I think it's becoming more prevalent with how widespread and available information is these days. But I think the biggest thing is to implore your kids to be earnest and to be individual and to be creative. Try to engage them as much as you can in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anything bugging you today, you know, and it takes work. And it you know, I have no interest in having kids of my own. I wasn't sure for a while, but I had a long think about it. And while I think I would do a pretty good job, I can't devote all of my time and energy to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely get sort of a second hand through my sister and my brother and coworkers and everything. And raising kids is exhausting. So
it sure is.
And by the time they're at the point where like you would want to have a really good heart to heart with them about, you know, what's going on at school and are the kids treating you okay and tell me about your friends and everything, you've already had 3 years of them, like three, four, five, 7 years of them, like constantly yelling in your ear. Constantly. You haven't had a good night's sleep in years. So it can
That's
be
not
difficult.
Quite how it was with me, but it's
I, again,
not
I'm,
all sunshine and roses either.
Yeah, this is all secondhand information. I definitely have one of my coworkers is like, yeah, man, it's a lot harder than they told me it was going to be. And I'm like, see?
It's absolutely one of the hardest things that I've ever done. And at the same time, I just get kind of sad sometimes because it's easy to get overwhelmed. But it's also, I see areas where people put things on certain ages of kids, you know, the terrible twos, this kind of stuff. Or, oh, you have a 16-year-old? I'm so sorry. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
My kid was freaking awesome when she was a teenager. She didn't go through any of that weird shit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a given. It's not an absolute. But at the same time, okay, so that's like kid stuff. I think it gets really a lot more complicated with children and how you raise them because you are not the only person raising them. your village is raising them. It was a little easier with my daughter because she's a female and different stuff would happen. At least 4 or 5 times I can remember, you know, other kids would say, don't cry. And I'd say, don't you ever tell her that. She can cry anytime she wants.
Absolutely.
But what about, okay, so that's like kid stuff, which is awesome. What about you, your age, men your age, trying to make this transition into being more whole people, learning this emotional intelligence, learning how to express emotions and let them out? How can the people around you support that?
So I think it's, you know, I came to terms a long time ago with like not being able to fix the problems of the world in the way that, you know, in the grand, I can wave a magic wand sort of thing. The way I've decided that I can help everyone is to sort of lead by example, to help myself, and then try to encourage everyone around me to do the same. You've now provided me with a slightly larger platform than just people I encounter on the day-to-day. But, but basically, like, you know, trying to consider what you're doing and whether it is healthy for you and whether it is what you actually want. I think one of the most valuable things about taking a long vacation is that you basically get to get a fresh perspective on how you're living life. You know, even from the minutiae of, you know, what you're eating to like, what am I doing? What did I do in the last couple months that's of note? Like, did I do anything interesting? Have I made any forward progress? Am I happier? Is that okay? You know, I think people put a lot of pressure on themselves to do that sort of thing. But I think that the sort of core of it is trying to live authentically. And trying to, I guess, kind of figure out what makes you happy and what you're passionate about and pursuing that. I think that if you are aware, if you are sort of one of the people who are a bit more enlightened or have figured some of this stuff out, trying to share it with people. You know, I talk about Michelle a lot because she has helped me a ton, like improve as a human being, let alone a man. And, you know, so I'll talk to my coworkers and I'll talk to my friends about, you know, oh, have you heard of this thing called love languages? And, you know, it's ways people express their love to each other. And
That's cool.
Or have you heard about intensive versus expansive? Or have you heard about, you know, islands versus waves versus anchors? You know, all these sort of different bonding and emotional theory stuff that I learned from Michelle. She's a huge geek about that sort of thing, and I am incredibly beneficial as a part of it.
But, I know. I'm listening to some of this going, man, I got to talk to Michelle again and ask her about those.
Oh, she's great. Absolutely. But like even stuff like being willing to ask people how they're doing and, you know, is in, you know, kind of pressing them for it. Like I have a friend of mine that has become fast friends with me at work, and he's been through a lot of shit in his life. And because of that, and sort of his coping mechanism is to kind of normalize it a bit. And so he is much more willing to share that with people than he was before that. You know, he's gone through a lot of trauma in his life. And it really the thing that builds connection between people, whether it's friends, whether it's romance, whatever it is, the thing that strengthens relationship is sharing a vulnerability. And so he was sharing with me a bunch of trauma from his past as a way to sort of, you know, lay down his hand of cards and say, this is some stuff I'm dealing with. And it's been a lot of trouble for me. And, you know, it's been really rough. And, you know, sort of bearing that vulnerability is what connects people, you know, because it really gives something for your empathy to attach onto.
One of the things I keep coming back to is we all just want to feel loved and we want to feel listened to.
Yes.
And cared about. And so that whole thing that you mentioned about, how are you? I'm fine.
Yeah.
And sometimes, yeah, you're absolutely right. People don't want to hear. They were just being nice. They really don't want to hear how you are. And they especially don't want to hear you talk about difficult emotional stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's, You know, I guess it depends on the context and that sort of thing. Like if I'm passing by someone in the hall and saying, like, how you doing? Oh yeah, well, you know, I've been really depressed lately and that sort of thing. It's like, well, all right, well, let's talk about that. Let's work on this. I mean, I have a meeting to go to, but this is more important and we should really talk about it. So like trying to get maybe more one-on-ones with people, like going out to dinner, grabbing a beer or something like that. That's really the place people will open up the most.
Here's what I'm noticing, Paul. All of these things that you're talking about, are you doing things for other people?
Yeah.
And the question that I asked was, how do we support you? If you could choose any kind of support, just any kind of support that helps that part of you deepen and grow and come out and all the things that you want, what does that look like? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I suppose it's different for every person. I'd think of love languages. Like, I'm not really very big on words of affirmation, but like, for something like that, I feel very prideful of the work that I do with my friends and helping them. So when someone says, like, wow, that's really amazing that you would do that, I'm like, yeah, thanks, man. I really appreciate that.
Because
it is like, you know, people are sharing these vulnerabilities and you're sharing this vulnerability of, you know, I helped this friend and I want them to succeed. You know, I guess maybe that's part of it is like when someone does help you, to thank them for it and to follow through on it. Because that's really what a lot of caregivers want, is they want to see you succeed. They want you to be happy. So live life to your fullest, I guess. Pay it forward, you know, like do this for someone else. Help us fix the world. Because, yeah, I have noticed that, like, you know, even if it's just getting people together for a party or something, I don't mind doing it, but, like, I don't want to be the only one doing it. It's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, I know. I've gone through a lot of iterations of trying to figure out how to do the best king party I could do, because I love doing king parties and having my friends come over, but I also want to enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I don't want to pay for it the day before and the day after. I don't want to have that happen.
So yeah, maybe that's what we want, is to help share the burden, to help propagate the change and stuff.
When I think of the question that I asked, I suppose my mind goes to like specifics, like how to hold space for emotions that want to get expressed, how to facilitate that in a manner that feels comfortable, how to help when society puts its shit on you. Like say you're the partner of a guy who is trying to do this transitional stuff.
Yeah. I'd say spend a lot of time talking with them and try and get as unguarded as possible. Yeah, sort of lower your own mask, as it were. I find that sharing a bit of vulnerability with someone softens them. It helps them share vulnerability as well. So a lot of times when, you know, I'm like, hey man, you seem like you're overworked, you're stressed, you know, it seems like you're working, oh yeah, well there's lots to do and that sort of thing. And you're like, well, I mean, you know, it's important to make time for yourself. I was, you know, at a certain point, I drove myself into depression because of how anxious I was. I was putting so much pressure on myself that I basically drove myself into a panic attack of some kind, and I had to re-examine how I was living my life. And like, oh wow, yeah. And like, so is what's really bugging you, man? So just like kind of being willing to share a bit of yourself to
gives the other person a foot in the door, yeah, or that opening, and you being willing to do that,
yeah,
it's almost like they can assume that you will be able to hear it if you're able to say it.
And think of everyone as like, you know, they've got their guard up, they've got their swords and their shields up at all times, and so when you're someone who they haven't encountered really in this context, you don't know they don't know if you're a friend or a foe. And so if you are willing to lower your guard first and see, I am willing to make myself vulnerable. I'm willing to put up my own guard and give you something that if you chose to, you could hurt me with. To show you that if you want to share something with me, that I will not hurt you with it. You know, it's trying to escalate the situation from the common a status quo, because the common status quo is pretty guarded and pretty snipey. And, you know, I'm happy that my office doesn't play a lot of office politics, but, you know, working in that kind of environment must be a fucking nightmare. Not knowing who you can trust and that sort of thing. That's what a lot of everyday life is for people. So putting yourself out there as someone who is willing to earn that trust, who is willing to show, hey, I've been through some stuff and I've sort of figured out some things and I'd like to help you.
Mm-hmm. Or even just be here to listen. Yeah. Which in itself is a help.
Yeah. So learning how to listen and learning how to not fix people's problems was a thing of mine. Like I said, I work in software. All I ever do is solve problems. That is like my constant. Everything in my body is wired towards it. So trying to understand when it's a logical problem of like, oh, I can't figure out how to do this. I can't figure out how to keep a job or to get the job I want or whatever. Or it's an emotional problem of, man, I really hate my job, but it's what I need to do right now. And you just need to be there and empathize with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's tricky, but I recommend lots of practice.
Yeah, so much more communication between people. That's what I would love to see.
Yeah, you know, try and expose yourself to a variety of people, and, you know, cuddle parties and kink meetups and stuff tend to do that.
Sometimes I get the impression that that guardedness is such a huge barrier, especially with men, that you start to try and break down that wall a little bit and talk, and really they go on overwhelmed pretty quick. And whether it's because they're not used to feeling those emotions, or they don't want to feel those emotions because they're so unfamiliar and, you know, they're upsetting and what have you. It's almost like the dam comes down and they go, okay, this feels shitty, so I'm never doing this again.
Yeah, that was one of the other things that my friend mentioned about West Virginia. They're like, oh, why would I see a therapist? That would make me uncomfortable. Why would I do anything that would make me uncomfortable?
Like, wow.
Yeah.
Because you're going to die 10 years sooner if you don't.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. No, it's absolutely wild. And, you know, people are at different points on their emotional journey. Like, you know, some of my friends I've made really quickly, you know, because we're on the kind of the same wavelength. Some of their friends, you know, I have a friend who's like 50 who I work with. And it's taken a lot to sort of get him out of his shell. And, you know, he has a lot of, he's an interesting case because, like, he's got a lot of, like, the sort of old school male mentality of, I need to provide for my family. Like, he got let go from his job recently. And, you know, he's really upset because he's not going to be able to spend his daughter's senior year with her. Mm. And he's like, but I have to move away. I have to get a job so that I can provide for her. I think in the end, he's being stubborn about it. He's not realizing that one of the ways he can provide for her is something that he wants, which is to stay close to her and be emotionally connected to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't necessarily like that, you know, providing for her financially isn't the most beneficial thing he can do.
No, as I understand it, though, that's something that is just basically a given, that the connection between men and their career, it's sort of like they're defined by their career. You know, the thing about what women want most and what men want most, you know, we're just going heavy duty into the binary here, but
sure.
Men want to be admired, women want to be adored. And admired, like, for what they do, for what they provide, for being able to support their family, for being able to help other people be happy in their family and take care of them. Yeah, it's fascinating.
It's really interesting because, like, you know, I understand that for a long time that's kind of how it was. Like, you know, the men had to provide for their families because the women weren't allowed to work, or, you know, they were too focused on, you know, whatever else. But the workspace is changing a lot, and, you know, I grew up with my dad providing most of it, but, like, my mom was working ever since I was in grade school. It was all part-time, and it was through the school so she could remain close. But, like, you know, I think she would have been wildly more successful in, you know, what she was doing beforehand. But, you know, that was the sacrifice that she made for us.
Mm-hmm.
things are changing a lot. Like, you know, now with the economy being kind of shittier, everyone has to work. But it's also liberating in that, like, men and women are more equal partners in the relationship than ever before. And so that opens up a bit of a deviance from that, like, well, the men have to work and provide for everything, you know, and it's nice that it's changing.
Yeah, I just wrote a story about, it's Masturbation Month, in case you didn't know. And so during Masturbation Month, I write a little erotic thing every single day, and I'm a little bit behind because, you know, being able to just turn that creative tap on demand is a little tough.
Yeah.
But one of the stories that I wrote was about a guy who, he was already feeling a little bit uneasy because his girlfriend made more money than he did. But, you know, he's fine with that. He's okay with it. Then he got fired. Mm-hmm. He's thinking, oh my God, my whole life is going to change. I'm probably going to lose a girlfriend because, I mean, she made more than me already, but now...
Why would she possibly keep me around?
Exactly.
Because all of his worth was put up into his job.
Yeah, and of course, you know, from my femdom point of view... She makes him a proposition and says, look, you know, I would love to have someone at home taking care of absolutely everything. So why don't you, you know, be sort of my wife, if you will. Why don't you be my sort of sex slave at home in a very negotiated manner to make sure that everybody's treated fairly and all that kind of stuff. In chastity, of course, because, you know, that's a recent fascination of mine. But I had fun with sort of flipping the roles. And clearly everything, you know, this whole strap-on thing flips the role humongously.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's an incredibly vulnerable thing, and it requires a lot of trust and a lot of vulnerability.
And I think that that's why I got so fascinated with all of this other stuff, is because I've watched that vulnerability happen with so many guys. I've watched that not only happen, but just incredibly improve and deepen intimacy in relationships. It's almost as if by engaging in pegging, and of course, you know, I'm starting to sound like one of those people that's like, this is my passion, so of course it can save the world.
I think that passion saves the world. You know, the friend that I was talking about, he was really down when we met up with him recently, and, you know, he was in dire straits, but I got to talking to him about heavy metal music, and he's like, oh my God, and blah, 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 and this and that. And you could see how animated he was. And I'm like, you need to, like, fucking do this. Just do something with this, because it is so clear how happy it makes you.
I know, when you see their eyes light up.
Yeah.
That's what I just want to say. Okay, so that, what you just felt when we talked about that, follow that. Go down that path, wherever it takes you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. You know, mostly.
Yeah, I'm working towards that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're an amazing example of it. Like, I have a lot of respect for you for, you know, doing something that you were incredibly passionate about and driving forward to it.
Oh, thank you.
I can't imagine that it's been something that has been easy, but you do it in a way that makes you seem fearless, and that's something to be admired.
Fearless, wow, that's quite a word. Mm-hmm. I recognized recently that even though I started off calling myself a writer, which I absolutely am, this whole thing of doing the podcasts and interacting with people and answering their questions. Oh, okay, well, basically what I'm doing is I'm holding space for people. I'm holding space for people, and I'm reassuring them that their desires are not weird or bad or different or strange, like I assumed they were when it was me, just me, judging my own desires.
Yep. Getting in your own head about it.
Yeah, that was decades ago. And so over and over again, I hear people say, you just hold such a safe space for all of that, and it really is the only space we have.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, that's so sad. So yeah, saving the world one ass at a time, or changing the world one ass at a time.
Yeah, you know, and I sort of joke that Michelle, and no, I feel like it's earnest. Like, she's, you know, saving the world in her own way, and
it's just
like, you know, holding space for people and, you know, showing someone that there is an alternative and that sort of thing. And I think that's part of maybe one of the big themes that I've been harping on, is that, you know, trying to look at what is and deciding if it's a good idea or not. You know, I am heterosexual, and I have a lot of respect for anyone who's just been very intentional about it. You know, whether you're homosexual, heterosexual, polyamorous, monogamous, whatever, I don't care. As long as you do it intentionally, as long as you thought about it, as long as it's not because it was the easiest answer. I'm very cautious of easy answers.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm trying to decide if it's me making the choice or if it's status quo that's built it in for me.
Yeah, and we're all kind of doing it our own way. I mean, I'm doing the podcast, I'm answering people's questions, I'm holding the space. I loved what Michelle said to me. This will probably be on the podcast too, where she says, you know, with the cuddling thing, it's almost like they just sort of let me love them for an hour.
Yeah.
And I thought that was just the most beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And you're seeing people at work going, so how are you really? You know, so
yeah.
Talk to me. And we're all making a difference in the world in our own way. Human connection is what makes the world go round and what helps keep us all much happier. So the
Absolutely.
Better human connection we can have with each other, no matter how we choose to do it, then I think the happier we're all going to be.
Absolutely. You know, just trying to make everyone happy, yourself included. That part's important.
I love the story you told about the backpacking, though, because I'm a backpacker.
Yeah.
And I know what it feels like to get out there in the wilderness.
Yeah, you sort of separate from society.
The way that I describe it is that you really kind of don't have any idea how much input you get just walking around in the world on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So much visual, so much audio. It's just intense. And we don't experience it as that because we're used to it. And then you get up in the mountains,
mm-hmm.
85% of it's gone. You just have some audio and all visual. And it's an absolutely amazing thing. I call it emptying my brain out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's amazing because it sort of takes you out of your pattern and sort of gets you to reexamine everything you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, humans are incredibly good at being efficient. You know, most people don't think like for 90% of their day. I wake up, I get in the shower, I go to work, I get to work, I read my emails. Only until like maybe halfway through the day does my brain actually turn on. That drive to work was all autopilot. It was all like learned, you know, memory behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to actually engage my brain for most of it. And it's the same with, you know, like taking a walk or something like that. It's like most of the time you're seeing all these beautiful things everywhere, but your brain is filtering it out because it's on autopilot or because it's focused on something else.
Yeah, and you can't do autopilot when you're backpacking.
Yeah. So I one of the things that has made me a happier person in my life is building time into my week to do nothing, to literally just remove myself from my normal patterns, my normal environments.
Hmm. I thought you were going to say building time into your life to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it is. For me, I'm constantly bombarded with distractions and media and all this sort of thing. So disconnecting and reconnecting with myself is what does it for me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, building something into your life to challenge yourself or to, you know, break away from your normal patterns, you know, whether that's going for a walk or going to a kink event or learning a new hobby or something.
When my daughter was younger and we would drive from one place to another, and you know, you do these drives a lot, especially if you live in the same place and she has been raised here most of her life. Sometimes we would drive somewhere, and when she got old enough to realize that I was turning a different way, she'd question it. And I go, we're definitely going where you think we're going. We're just going a different way. Why, Mommy? Because it's fun to do different things.
Yeah.
That's what I would always tell her. And then, of course, when your kids parrot it back to you, it blows your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think my favorite, I did this with my motorcycle a fair amount. I need to do it more now that I'm to fun on the weekend and stuff like that, but my favorite part about my motorcycle is it doesn't have a clock and doesn't have GPS. You know, I can, if I need to, like hook up my phone to a headset or something like that. But like while I'm on the motorcycle, I can just be, you know, I can be present. I can look at everything around me. I can try to go this way. I can try to go that way. I can, you know, enjoy the view. I can, you know, take this turn a little bit faster than I would if I was just kind of doing autopilot or whatever.
I know what you mean, because I've ridden a motorcycle before. I've had one, and I would describe it as a very immersive experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which you know, that type of experience, that quality, has such a richness to it, because it does filter out so many other things. You're not in touch with all those other things, because you can't be.
Yeah, there's I play a fair amount of video games, and there's the theory of flow. And the idea is that, like, you get to be so good at the thing that you're doing that you're almost watching yourself do it as an outside perspective. It's just everything's automatic. It's all you're so into it that, like, everything is happening naturally. Mm-hmm. And you just kind of separate from it. That's commonly referred to as flow. And, you know, you can do this whether you're doing your job or whether you're being an artist or playing mm-hmm. video games, or I feel like motorcycle, that's the place that everyone wants to be, because it's very tranquil, and it's mm-hmm. you feel accomplished, and you're able to kind of observe yourself doing the thing, and you get to
time slows down.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah, that same guy, Ken Robinson, wrote a book, and he described that exact phenomenon.
Yeah.
And he said, that's when you know you are where you want to be. And these are the qualities to look for, to know that you're actually in this space.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember what he called it. But anyway, I will have all those links in the Linkorama for all of you listeners. And Paul, I can't thank you enough for just, like, opening up yourself and talking with me about all of this stuff. I find it really fascinating. I thought it was really important also to get a guy's perspective on this. So I appreciate you sharing yours.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. It was absolutely lovely.
I'm glad.
Congratulations. You have come to the end of the podcast number 200 marathon at Pegging Paradise. Well done. So I do want to apologize one more time for the sound quality of my mic in this last interview with Paul. It was coming through my desktop microphone instead of my one that I paid a lot of money for that gives me this lovely sound quality. So I do apologize for taking you back to, like, the sound quality of one of my very first podcasts practically. But it was an excellent interview, and I really wanted you to hear it. So I put it up anyway, and thanks for making your way through it and having a listen. Now, I'm going to give you a recap of all of those amazing links that the three of us have for you. The first one, of course, is Kate Lurie. That's the piece I read at the very beginning of this podcast. She's based in Encino, California. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist. And once again, she specializes in alternative sexuality issues, and she does do Skype sessions. The next link is Emily Nagoski. That was who Michelle mentioned. And there's a TED Talk link that I have for you. That's the one Michelle mentioned about unwanted arousal. And then there's a ton of links for Mark Green. I've got 4 articles: Why Men Keep Demanding Sex from Their Partners Over and Over, Touch Isolation, How Homophobia Has Robbed All Men of Touch, The Lack of Gentle Platonic Touch in Men's Life is a Killer, and Why Do We Murder the Beautiful Friendships of Boys? And then I have a couple of more links for you around Mark Green, and also Dr. Saliha Bava. He wrote a book with Dr. Saliha Bava called The Relational Book for Parenting. And this is a short description. The emotional suppression of boys contributes directly to the epidemic of loneliness faced by 44 million middle-aged adults. It contributes to depression, addiction, divorce, violence, and early mortality, hurting boys and girls, men and women equally. A powerful solution, starting as early as age 4, help our sons and daughters grow more authentic, joyful relationships in their personal and professional lives. So there's a link for the book where you can buy it on Amazon, and also a link with a kind of a short video interview of Mark Green and Dr. Bava interviewing them. And next, we have a link for Gary Chapman. He is the guy who wrote The 5 Love Languages. There's a link to his website where you can find everything he offers, as well as a quiz to find out what your 5 love languages are. You can take the quiz on the website. You can also buy the book there, and I think that there are audiobooks as well. And then there's Bonnie Badenoch. She runs relationshipschool.net. And this is the woman that enlightened Michelle about emotional co-regulation. So there's a link to a specific post of hers. It's a 3-minute read, I think it said, how to feel safe in your relationship. And she specifically talks about co-regulation. Then we move on to Brené Brown. Brené Brown, I went ahead and put the regular 2 links that I probably have linked to 3 or 4 times now about vulnerability and shame, the power of vulnerability, and listening to shame. Those 2 are just invaluable if you have not watched them. They're about 15, 20 minutes apiece, and they've got millions and millions of views at this point. And I also have a link to the article that I mentioned where she talks about her number 1 life hack for relationships. And that is the thing about the story I'm making up right now, or the story I'm telling myself. So yes, that's Brené Brown. The next link is for Stan Tatkin. This is the guy that Michelle mentioned who wrote the book Wired for Love, How Understanding Your Partner's Brain and Attachment Style Can Help You Defuse Conflict and Build a Secure Relationship. He has other offerings on his website as well, and that book is there. And then I have a link to Betty Dodson's website, and specifically a link to her body sex workshops. Remember, Michelle swore by those and said that was something that changed her life. Apparently, she does these in Midtown Manhattan. And yes, there are a couple scheduled fairly soon. So there's a link to that if you'd like to explore it. And also, there are certified body sex teachers, instructors, who she has certified to do the same thing. And then we have some links for Michelle Renee herself. One is CuddleSanDiego.com, where she offers her cuddling services, and the other is the blog called Sex After Marriage. She's not real active on this blog right now, but there is some amazing stuff there. And there's also a list to all kinds of different services she offers, coaching, relationship coaching. She has so much good information, so I wanted to put a link to that as well. And then we move on to 2 links about cuddling. One is cuddleparty.com and the other is cuddlelist.com. Those are pretty simple, but they are also there in the Linkorama in case you are looking for a certified cuddler in your area. And then we go to Jennifer Siebel Newsom. She is the filmmaker who produced The Mask You Live In. It was funny. When I finally looked it up, I found that not only did Paul have the title wrong, but I had the title wrong too. So the title of that film is The Mask You Live In. Now, Jennifer Siebel Newsom started with misrepresentation, like M-I-S-S, misrepresentation. And this was looking at the ways that limiting gender norms affect girls and women negatively. Then she made the movie The Mask You Live In, and that exposed how those same norms harm boys and men. She's got one in the works that she had a successful Kickstarter funding program for, and it is premiering in 2019. It's called The Great American Lie, and it says it will complete the story by examining the effect of these limiting gender norms on society at large. Then I have a link from Human Comics, which are the stages of hugs that Paul told us about. And there's one I put in here that we did not mention, but when Paul and I were talking, I thought about this because we were talking about intimacy and BDSM and how sometimes BDSM facilitates that. So I put a link to a short article by Midori, and it's called BDSM's Dirty Secret, The Real Risk of Kinky Sex. And let's see, from there I have Ken Robinson, Sir Ken Robinson, and this is the guy who has, I believe this TED Talk has been viewed more than any other TED Talk on TED, period. Do schools kill creativity? Because remember, Paul and I were talking about schools and raising kids and what schools do to kids sometimes. And then we spoke as well about the flow. Remember, Paul talked about finding the flow. Well, I looked up the book that Sir Ken Robinson wrote about that. It's called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. And it looks as if he's written another follow-up book about how to find your element. So There's links to the TED Talk as well as his book, The Element, and his other offerings and books that he's written. He's done a lot more than I was aware of. So all of those are going to be there in the Linkorama for you. Please do explore them at your leisure. Take a look at what calls to you. Investigate it. Follow the paths. And please do also have those conversations with your partner, with your partners, with your children, with your parents, with everyone around you. Give those things a try. Try being vulnerable. See what happens. And know that we are all out there just doing the very best we can with what we were given, how we were raised, what our models were, but that we can make choices and we can grow and we can do something different. So if you are someone who's looking for what's missing in your life, like Paul was, or if you're someone who just can't find that way to make it work well in your relationship, take a gander at some of these links and see if some of them have a few answers for you. You never know. There's a lot of good information in these links. So please do explore them and enjoy them. I want to thank each and every one of you for listening, for downloading these podcasts. I mean, I'm on number 200. Holy crap. Holy crap. This is like, that's a lot of podcasts, people. And just like I always say, when I reach an important date like this, you know, I couldn't do this if it wasn't for you guys who downloaded and listened. I would just be a podcast and I'd be putting these recordings up and no one would care. You care. You like them. You appreciate them. You find comfort in them. You get information out of them. They help your relationships. I mean, there is no better testimony than all those lovely letters that you guys wrote me when I asked you to cheer me up and tell me what I'd done for you. And I'm thrilled. I'm absolutely thrilled that what I put out there in the world is something that's valuable to you all, that helps you find pleasure, that helps your love life, that helps build intimacy with your partner, and that gives you awesome ways to explore your bodies. It's all just, it gives me the warm fuzzies, you guys. It really does. Thank you all so much for downloading and listening. You rock. Happy pegging.